Okay, we're going to go ahead and call the finance, House Finance Committee to order today, February 15th, time is 8:40. With us today is Representative Moses, Representative Kelly, myself, Representative Meyer, Vice Chair Stokes, Representative Jewell, Representative Hopper, and Representative Clark. Today we're taking up two items. The first item is a continuation of House Bill 273. Okay. Delay payments for allowable absences, we have four amendments on this particular bill. The testimony has been closed. After we're done with this bill, then we'll go on to the fast track supplemental House Bill 421. So with that, let's go right to the House Bill 273. Representative
Barbara and his trusty staff. Does anybody want to get hot? Come on, I'll just do it. Okay. Very good. So I think the first item then, correct, is amendments. And so the first amendment is Representative Jewell.
Mr. Chairman, I have two amendments,
and
of which I'll only be offering one.
And the amendment that I will be offering is F.5 Cook 2706. Mine haven't been numbered.
Two.
Is that number two?
Yeah, number two.
So I will not be offering amendment number one, Mr. Chairman.
We have amendment one and moving amendment two.
And I will move amendment two.
Okay. I'll object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number two allows a student who's attending college out of state to collect a dividend if in that qualifying year the student returns for at least 90 days. It gets them back in the state, and if they're here during the summer months, it probably gets them engaged in some sort of wage earning mode so that they're making money to try and get back. But also, I think they're being kept in the loop pretty much about what their potential future is in terms of career in the state. And I think that, for kids go to school, and I understand that if they haul it, eventually they'll get it back. But for some, for actually probably a lot more families, we realize, the sum of $1,000 in the overall cost of college doesn't sound like much to many students and many families. That is quite a bit. And I would encourage a positive look at this by the committee and urge the ESCO for amendment number two.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman. There's a couple issues, and one is legal, and a couple of concerns are substantive. And with respect to the legal questions that the amendment raises, I wonder if I could have someone from the Department of Law testify.
Sure,
who would
you like?
Is there a lawyer?
Nobody will admit to it.
Yeah. Well, they're Republican, nothing would change.
Hi, Chris Pogue, POAG. I work at Department of Law, Assistant Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman, can I share some answers in case there's any questions? The first one is the amendment, there's a number of allowable absences that allow a person in a certain legislatively created class to collect permanent fund dividends once they leave the state of Alaska if they tend to return. But it seems to me that the amendment does is carve out exceptions for a student category and another, partly based on it's nice because they may need it, and it's we want our students to come back. But the fact of the matter is what the bill does without the amendment is it holds permanent fund dividend checks for that student to come back and live and work in the state. And then when they do come back and establish residency, they get all the permanent fund dividend checks they would have received if they had stayed in the state. And so in fact, they receive rather a large, nice nest egg when they come back to the state, establish residency, and live here. The other thing that it does is it may enter the calculus of a student who wants to go out of state to say, well, I'd rather be a non-resident and get in-state tuition at an out-of-state institution because of my savings results in 10 or 20 times what I may receive in the form of a permanent fund dividend check, and therefore the established out-of-state residency may benefit me. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, if it is so important for a person to stay in state or to retain a permanent fund dividend, that the University of Alaska has a tremendous program to educate our students and contribute to the welfare of the state of Alaska, while spending their permanent fund dividend money in-state, which also has a huge economic benefit to the entire population of the state, not just that individual. So those are my sort of public policy concerns over the amendment. I would ask, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right, if Mr. Pope goes into more detail on the legal issue. Okay.
Members of the committee, I think I testified briefly on the phone at your last hearing on this bill. And I probably should start back with a little bit of background to help us understand allowable absences in the permanent fund dividend. Persons who receive the permanent fund dividend are Alaska residents. The Supreme Court has allowed us to go a little bit broader than that through the legislative provisions and say that they're permanent Alaska residents. And what is a permanent Alaska resident is defined by statute and regulation. And the gist of it is, if you're in, you have to be present in the state and you have to intend to remain here indefinitely. If you're not present in the state, which are what allowable absences are, you have to intend to return and intend to remain indefinitely. So if you're a permanent Alaska resident, you get the PFD. Obviously, subjective intent alone is probably not grounds enough to make determinations. It would be practically almost impossible for PFD to just year things based on people's subjective intent. So they have, through the years, adopted statutory and regulatory provisions that allow for objective criteria to help them make that decision as to who are permanent residents. Specifically in the category of folks who are not present in the state when they apply for a PFD and qualify for an allowable absence category, the 13 allowable absence categories exceptions are essentially legislative findings that these folks, although not present, are likely to return to the state. The Supreme Court has looked at this issue on a number of occasions. As you might have guessed, this is an area that gets challenged quite a bit, and the challenges have been upheld to equal protection challenges. In other words, the 13 existing allowable absence categories, the Supreme Court has said in the equal protection analysis, which it applied a minimum scrutiny to, that the legislative objective bared a fair and substantial relationship to the means that were used. And that's the guideline that this same provision will be held to if and when, and given the testimony you've heard, it sounds like when, this provision is challenged before the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court has said is that the permanent fund dividend, in part, is designed to encourage folks who are Alaska residents to stay here or to return here. So our provisions on allowable absence categories have to be consistent with the purpose of that, which is that we're accepting these people from being physically present in our state because we've decided that they're likely to return. There's been a number of amendments that have been offered to this provision that have been based on need, and need-based exceptions are not going to survive that scrutiny, in my opinion. The exception has to show that we have legislative findings to support a position that they're likely to return. Now, turning to Representative Jewell's amendment, in common sense, using common sense approach, if you return, we already sort of apply this provision. If you return to the state every year on an allowable absence for college for 90 days, that's a pretty good indication, common sense-wise, that you intend to return. However, there's two problems with this. The first problem is the statistical evidence that Director Barton's division has put together doesn't support that. The statistical evidence indicates that college students, when they leave, if they are likely to return, it's within the first 2 years. And after that, it drops off substantially. So that's one problem. That doesn't mean that the common sense doesn't still apply, but it does present that the statistics don't match the common sense that we're applying to the amendment. The other concern that I have is that by accepting out one category, we've made another class. So we already have two classes. We have one class which is general allowable absences up to 180 days, and we have another class which is those 13 allowable absences. which quite frankly have been criticized by a lot of Alaskan residents as an elite class of folks who are allowed to leave the state. We'd be creating a third class of allowable absence categories for students. Creating classes makes this provision less defensible for me. If the common sense and the wisdom of the legislature decides that we should have a 90-day provision, I would encourage the amendment to apply across the board to all 13 allowable absence categories. If common sense applies that if you come back for 90 days per year, you're likely to return at the end of your allowable absence, it seems that that common sense would apply across the board to all 13 categories. So I think it would improve chances of success, this provision, if it applied to all allowable absence categories. And I think the only issue then remains is whether or not this legislative body wishes to give credence to the statistics that Director Barton's division has put together, which don't support this amendment as it is. But I believe the provision is defensible because common sense approach supports it. When this legislature approved the 13 categories, it was based on common sense. It wasn't based on statistics. If you look at those categories, it looks like those folks were absent for means beyond their control. And so we had apparently a reason to believe they were likely to return. That same common sense applies to this provision. It just isn't borne out by the statistics. So that's the policy decision you all have to make. But it would be more defensible if it applied across the board.
Thanks. So I'm going to start at the end first, and then if you created a separate class, would it still be the same old scrutiny that the court would look at it, whether it means or going to meet the ends?
Through the chair, Representative Cotrulla, yes. The Alaska Supreme Court has said the permanent fund dividend is an economic interest, and as a result of that interest, it receives minimal scrutiny.
So that helps a little bit, but the second thing is I totally agree with you on the common sense approach that if you're going to return every year for the 90 days, that you're showing the likelihood of coming back to the state. I'm going to use myself as the example because that's exactly what happened to me. I went outside of school, came home, worked every year, came back. Not that everybody's going to do that. The second thing is that I'm listening to what you say about the statistical evidence, but the statistical evidence that we've got is based just on 1 year. It's a 1996 study. I mean, that's the year when I started to think about it that the .com was going wild in the places where at least a lot of Alaskan students I know go to study, Washington, West Coast, California. So there's a whole lot of things that come into play that 1 year snapshot simply doesn't show anymore. I mean, don't you think that the court would look at that too, that the fact that really we don't have a study that was done with any kind of statistically valid methodology? Ms. Barton did a great job looking at that 1 year following it through. But really, that's not the kind of heavy-duty evidence that you need to outweigh something that's really minimal scrutiny, is it?
Through the chair, Representative Cotrulla.
It's a factor that would be considered, that we really don't have 10 or 20 years of statistics to outweigh minimum scrutiny.
Through the chair, Representative Cotrulla. Yeah, the statistical evidence, I think, it's a one-year survey. It's a statistically valid one-year survey. And I think it gave the permanent fund dividend and Representative Wyrock pause and reason to have concern about our assumptions that these folks were returning when the statistics showed that apparently they're not returning at the rate which we thought. So yes, in front of the Supreme Court, I will be making all the arguments that you're making today and encouraging the court to put little weight into the statistical evidence and spend most of the effort looking at the legislative findings that this is supported and that there is grounds to believe that folks are likely to return if they spend 90 days here in the state. However, I guess I would be the opposite example, and I was born and raised in Michigan. I went to college and law school there, and here I am in Alaska.
Here.
I didn't return to Michigan.
There's good reasons to come here. The last question is, so it might be a little bit better if we do it across the board, and that's something that is worth thinking about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer. Recently, the Supreme Court justice spoke here, and I noticed all four justices were there, and one of them wasn't, and it was suggested that they couldn't all be here. If they got killed in a plane crash, there'd be no one left to make the laws. So, but, this we're talking about a common sense approach. If
if common sense is going to be overruled, I just assume the courts do it rather than have them do it by tying our hands and forcing them to just do it just by my fear of exercising common sense that the court's going to let strike down. So that's not a question. That's just a statement that I'm going to support the amendment.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Representative Wark, anything else?
Just maybe clarification from Ms. Barton on the data she gathered might be helpful.
Sure.
Should I stay or go?
Sharon Barton, Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. The study was statistically valid. The number of individuals studied in each category did constitute a statistically valid sample for what we were doing. Last year, we took a sample of starting in 1995, tracked them through 2004. This year's study was 1996, and we tracked them through 2005. We chose a 10-year period because the statutes currently allow people to be out 10 years. We wondered what happened over a 10-year period. So that's the reason we went back. We, of course, could slice and dice this any way we wanted. We could start a new sampling each and every year, and the time period possible to be out would be different. We don't have any sense that anything has changed about return over that time, but we have not studied a pool that began in any other year more recent than 1996.
Questions from Ms. Barton?
Yeah, and I didn't mean to suggest that you've done anything wrong, as you certainly did. For those 2 years, you did the coming through. My question is more about the fact that, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that have changed in that interceding time frame, and we just don't know because we haven't had you go back and do that work. Which I guess is a question. Is that possible for the division to do, to go back and track what's happened in those intervening years at some point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kurtula, it is possible. The data is all there. It's very much a manual effort for us with our current computer system, so it's time-intensive, but it's absolutely possible.
Okay. Well, for now, I understand what you're saying, and I just think there have been a lot of intervening things that have happened and that we do know for those 2 years, but that's all we know for. So there's no way we can say that it necessarily applies to later years. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jewell, we'll let you have the last word.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We know what challenges we have and are facing with developing our workforce. It's a huge issue. For us here, and I think that this is something that would help those individuals make some decisions. You know, as a state, we really lay far behind in the number of people that actually will take that chance and get up, get an education. So I would hope this committee would see and support this.
Thank you, Representative Jewell. Okay, well, I'll maintain my objection, Madam Clerk.
Representative Hoffner?
No.
Representative Jewell?
Yes.
Representative Kelly? Representative Kutula?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Weirach?
No.
Representative Meyer?
No.
4-3.
Okay. Amendments fails?
Fails.
Okay.
We'll go on to Amendment 3. And Representative Kelly had to leave for a brief moment for a meeting, so I'll move Amendment number 3 for Representative Kelly. Somebody object to my amendment.
I will object.
And Ms. Ankliff, you're going to tell us what this amendment does, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kelly. Representative Kelly has a board meeting that he had to attend telephonically. He did apologize. This amendment, as was previously discussed in the committee, changes the qualifying period from 10 years down to 5 years. Questions that came up as a result of that were to the eligibility of folks who are already within that 10-year but beyond the 5 years, military folks, education folks, post-secondary students, and people out of the state taking care of family members and folks who have terminal illnesses. So we had Tam Cook, the drafter, put in an application section that would allow anyone who is currently in the system past that 5 years but under the 10 years, that would allow them to stay in and term out, if you will. So it's a grandfather clause, simply language that allows it. I've spoke with the department. They concur with this. And Mr. Chairman, that sums it up. We just basically make the allowance for those who are already in the system to term out and allow good faith on the part of the state.
Okay, very good. Representative Warwick?
That was explained well. I don't have any questions about what that's.
Let's see, you objected to my amendment. Do you support this?
I support them and I withdraw my objection.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Looks like Representative Kelly needs to leave more often.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, Amendment 3 then is adopted. If there's no objections to it. So we have the, there's one more. Amendment number 4, Representative Petula.
Yeah, I move the amendment.
Object. Just because I want to hear that.
Right.
For discussion purposes.
Well, we've heard the testimony that for people, particularly students, who go outside, that making it 1 year would actually make it into 3 years because of the time that the exemption students work. And my effort is to allow, really, because the person will be in state, to have it, and it would apply across the board, but it particularly would impact students, to allow them to have all 4 years. And it's really that last year of college, I think, can be very difficult. I think it's a very minor step, and I think it will allay a great deal of concern that we've heard across, you know, constituencies about the way that the new program would work. I have a lot of, I like the bill, I like the underlying way it's working, and just this one particular amendment I think would make it stronger.
Very good. Representative Warwick?
Yeah, I guess for the reasons I've already stated, which I incorporate by reference and append here too, I object to the amendment and then also refer to the testimony of Mr. Pogue and Ms. Barton on why I don't think it really works. So I have nothing further to say.
Anything else?
I'll just incorporate my comments to Mr. Pogue's as well, because I think that, you know, it's low scrutiny. I think the ends are met, the means are particularly narrow, and that it's justifiable.
Okay. I'll remove my objection.
Okay, Representative Warwick. Representative Stoltz has removed his objection. Anybody else would like to object?
No.
I think you do, yeah.
Okay,
so we do have objection. Madam Clerk.
Representative Walker?
Started with me again, eh?
So, you're hoping that she would rotate.
Yes.
Well, I did, but Foster was
okay. You want to pass?
I don't like that. That's a procedure I don't like, sir. But I'll say no at the moment, but I'm sure we'll revisit this amendment later.
Okay. Representative Jewell?
Yes.
Representative Petula?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Weirach?
No.
Representative Meyer?
No.
4-3, 4-8, 3-8.
Okay. I've got it. 4-5. Okay, we have the bill back for us. And at this time, I'd like to take a brief at ease. Okay, the House Finance Committee is back to order. We've finished the amendments. I just wanted to check to see if there's any other amendments that need to be done. Any other discussion? I think the amendments we had were very good, and hopefully we'll hear them again. if there's no other discussion, then let's entertain a motion.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move out CS for House Bill 273. Now, I guess finance amended as it's going to come out. 24-LS0871/F. And if there are attached fiscal notes,
I believe there's a due fiscal note from the Department of Revenue dated 2706.
With attached fiscal note with individual recommendations from the members.
Okay, any objections? Seeing none, the bill passes at its meeting. Okay, we'll sign the sheet, and while we're doing that, we'll take a brief at ease while we get ready for the next presentation, which is the fast track supplement. House Finance Committee is back in order, and I we have with us here Ms. Fraska. Cheryl Fraska. I had asked her to come at 2:15 because I figured our first bill would take longer than it did, and we were actually prompt and early, and so we fooled her, and I appreciate you coming over, Cheryl, and I know you ran over, and so it's good to have you.
Thank you.
If you would go ahead and start with kind of giving us a brief. By the way, I should tell everybody we're dealing with House Bill 421, which is the Fast Track Supplemental. If you want to just start it out with an overview, and then we'll, did I understand the Department of Law has to be somewhere, so we'll go right to Department of Law after your orientation.
Okay.
Ms. Fraska?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cheryl Fraska, Office of Management and Budget. And we do appreciate your bringing up what we describe as the Fast Track Supplemental. As you know, the general fund totals for this, as proposed, was $13.5 million. There's two kinds of requests in here. One are those things that require, or we request, early consideration due to timing of the funding being available. And then in terms of unanticipated events. And the second is a couple of projects that we would like to get a head start on in terms of some of the couple of capital requests. So it's not a question of unanticipated, it's more an issue of can we get going on a project earlier than waiting for the start of the next fiscal year. So in terms of the larger requests that we have in here, $4.1 million is for some disasters that have occurred in the past. As you know, we tend to fund them after the fact, so that's putting us into a supplemental request mode. The second largest area is $2.6 million for judgments and claims, as you've got the Department of Law here poised to speak to that. And there's also a budget amendment that relates to judgment and claims. And normally this is a section that you wouldn't see in the Fast Track Supplemental, but we're asking if you would consider it as part of that bill, really so we can get the funding earlier, get it out, and we avoid some interest charges. So it's a way, again, of saving some money by having earlier action on that request. The second is $2.6 million for corrections for inmate health care. This is related to having an aging as well as an increasing population in our prisons. And then again, we have $1 million for a phone system replacement. This is an example of where we're asking to get a head start on a project that's also included in our 07 capital budget. We'll have a budget amendment that would back this $1 million out of the amount that we're requesting for 07. But we've been having, the department can certainly speak to this, but having more and more failures of the phone system, especially up in Anchorage. So this is to get a head start on that process. There are two amendments that have been submitted since introduction. One is for $1.5 million in federal funds for Kotzebue sand building, storage building. Again, this is so we could get a head start on the project so we could meet the barge this spring if we can get earlier approval of the request. And then the Department of Law's judgment and claims amendment. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions. Otherwise, let you talk to the experts that are in the audience.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fraska. Any questions? Seeing none.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow.
Okay. Department of Law, you want to come back again, please? Okay. We're going out of order here a little bit. Department of Law is actually Section 5, so that would be line 10. On your spreadsheet. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The Department of Law is here today. For the record, I'm Catherine Dottie with the Department of Law. And with you today is Deputy Attorney General Craig Tillery. And we're here today to talk to you about the Department of Law's annual request for funding to pay judgments and claims that have arisen thus far since the last session. And we'd be happy to go through this in detail if you'd like to, or we can try to hit the high points, or we can just take questions. We appreciate your willingness to accommodate a time constraint and let us go first after Cheryl Fraska. And we also wanted to just underscore that there is a significant savings, especially on these more recent judgments with the new calendar year interest rate of 8.25%. We basically save half of the interest calculation by planning to be able to cut these checks on or about April 15th rather than June 30th.
Yeah, any questions? Let's see, we got section 5, and then you also have line 29 is your amendment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I thought I had not seen the revised bill, but there was an addition that takes the total to $3.269 million, and I don't know how it's reflected on your spreadsheet.
Okay. Well, we have $647 for the amendment, and then the original request is
2.6.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Representative Kutula?
Oh, I just wondered if you could just give us just a brief overview. I know you're pressed for what the cases are that you're paying the judgments for.
Would it help if I just kind of gave you a sort of some of the high points of it?
Please tell us for the record
who you are. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Craig Tillery. I'm Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. And I believe you have the spreadsheet on this one. Looking at some of the cases that are a little bit more expensive than others, we had a settlement with Spinago, which was a medical malpractice case. Was an inmate case. It was really one, almost a straight medical malpractice where we knew the person was having a problem with essentially what turned out to be ulcerative colitis. We recommended that he see a specialist, recommended that he get a colonoscopy, and it just wasn't followed up. And by the time that it was followed up on, they immediately went to surgery and had removed his colon. And just on almost just a straight medical malpractice analysis, it was determined that that was an appropriate settlement. One of the ones that's in actually a couple of places is has to do with Daniel Scott, an Alaska state trooper who was indicted for sexual assault and kidnapping. These cases stem out of that case. It involves settlements with a number of women whom he assaulted. That case is currently, the criminal case is still ongoing. These were all witnesses in that criminal case. The question has been asked about what can we do differently, and really the answer is nothing. I mean, you can do a lot of things differently, but there's no systemic change. You simply, this is a violation of the law. This is a crime, and you simply try to guard against it, but ultimately you can't prevent it through a systemic change. The Newton case is a case that gets some interest. It was the had to do with the exit exam and the failure to provide quickly enough for disabilities, people with disabilities to be able to take that exam. We actually dealt with that fairly promptly. We're a little disturbed by having to pay this amount. It was brought under a federal law that provides for attorney's fees. We worked out a settlement. It was a settlement that was in the line of what the state wanted rather than what the plaintiffs had wanted in terms of how it was to be implemented. The court awarded them a substantial amount of fees. We argued about it, and the federal court judge rejected our arguments, except that he did reduce us, I believe, in attorney fees down from about $500 to $300 an hour. Ultimately, we made the decision, looking at the case law, there was no sense in appealing this to the Ninth Circuit. We would simply be throwing good money after bad, because the Ninth Circuit law is pretty clear that it's in the discretion of the trial court. The Bacolus case has received some interest. It was a case where there was a person who worked for the state and was determined to be or was ultimately let go. They filed a lawsuit on a number of different claims, including whistleblower. It was determined that they had actually been speaking with some people in the legislature, among others. And that one went to trial, and a jury found against the state on about three or four different theories, all of which would have resulted in liability for the state. We were fairly successful in reducing an initially large damages claim on that one, and then we're able to settle it out in time with a slight further reduction and settle it out in time to put it in this year's judgment bill. there's my... And the Bush versus Cromer case, the last one I'll talk to you about, that was one of the ones I believe that we recently added. It's for a significant amount of money, $350,000. But it was a very difficult case for us. It was a five-year-old child who was in foster care. There was evidence that and he was bitten by a dog and bitten very severely. His face was essentially torn open. He's had several surgeries to try to repair both the scars and the nerve damage and so forth. His surgeon has stated that he may never regain all of his abilities. He will have visible scars for the rest of his life. He was severely traumatized. It was evidence that the agency was, in fact, aware that this dog had previously bitten another child. There was evidence that the social worker had said this may not be a good placement because you're combining a large dog with a fairly hyperactive child. And there were several other warnings that the state had had in light of all this and the severe injuries to the child that would have been very apparent to a jury and to a court. It was determined that it was necessary to settle it for that amount. So that's kind of a highlight, if you will.
Okay. Richard Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In perspective, and I apologize for not doing my own homework adequately here, but I didn't go back and sort of compare this level of settlement to sort of some trend analysis of the last few years. Is this sort of level of exposure and request for us, is this consistent with the past couple of years, or is this year, it just seems to be a little higher than what we've been experiencing?
On an individual case level, I think these verdicts are generally similar within what you might expect that from year to year things would go up. In terms of the total amount that we're bringing you, my understanding speak better than I, but I believe it's higher than last year, but certainly lower than some previous years.
I did through the chair, Representative Hawker, I recently completed an analysis of 10 years worth of these numbers, and we did have a one unusual year that was in excess of $10 million, but typically I would say that there have been 3 years that have been $3 million plus and a couple of years that have been less than $2 million, but this is certainly in the range. I just think there's more of these higher cost matters than have been in the recent past.
And Representative Hawker, if I might add, the one systemic change that will make a difference, if you look through these, you'll see a number of these cases came out of the last Marine Highway system, and they were all before the change to workers' compensation for those individuals, and that is one systemic change that will make a difference in the future.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? I'd just like to follow up on one comment, Kathy, that you made on the interest that we pay. Can you explain that again to me?
The current statute directs the state to pay interest in accordance with the 3 points above the 9th Federal Reserve level, and every calendar year it's recalculated. The court system sends out a memorandum, and that interest rate becomes applicable to any awards or settlements that the state enters into for that calendar year. For this calendar year, it increased from 6.25% from 2005 to 8.25%. The question came up on the Senate side of how much does the Treasury earn? So what is the real gap of what you're saving versus what you're spending in interest? And the Department of Revenue informs me that we should be using 3.7% earnings on the general fund. So that's almost a 5% gap. In terms of what the state can save over what it can earn on those same monies if they would remain in the Treasury.
Okay. All right, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, thank you very much. Okay, so we'll go back to just first group. On line two. Yes. Good afternoon. If you folks could tell us your names, who you're affiliated with. Let's see, we're talking section one and also 4B.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eric Swanson. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Administration, and I have with me Stan Herrera with our Enterprise Technology Services Division. Mr. Chairman, we're here today to talk about the one request the Department of Administration has in the Fast Track Supplemental. The request, as you pointed out, does appear in both sections 1 and 4B, and is requesting $1 million of general fund to be appropriated to the Information Services Fund, and then from that Information Services Fund for the purpose of telephone system replacement and stabilization work that we need to get started with in the current fiscal year. Mr. Chairman, as Cheryl Frasca explained, this was initially part of our FY07 capital budget, but because of events over the past several weeks and other things that lead us to believe that our portions or elements of our telephone system are not as stable as they need to be, we've determined that we would be better off reacting sooner rather than later to these situations. And Stan Herrera can give you some more detail of just what's been going on with our telephone systems if you'd like to hear that.
Yes, please. I think
good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stan Herrera. I'm with the Enterprise Technology Services Division with the Department of Administration. Back in November of 2005, Nortel Systems, which is the vendor that supports our phone switches, our PBXs in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. These are on the 465, 269, 451 exchanges on our phone system, notified the state of Alaska that effective April 1st of 2006, the state would no longer be supported in its current hardware and software configurations on those phone switches. Those phones represent about 14,000 in number in those three communities, and they are dispersed amongst many agencies, inclusive of the executive branch, legislative branch, and the court system in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks, respectively. Recently, we've had outages in Anchorage. I'm sure some of you may be aware, some more painfully than others, that when we have these outages, because of the current systems age, it's about 13 to 20 years in age. Bringing these systems back sometimes is on a lick and a promise, and we're trying to be a little more proactive, as Eric indicated, with trying to do some assessments of the PBX phone switches themselves, as well as the sites where these phones exist, and make some determinations as to migrating these to the newer technology, which is called Voice over Internet Protocol, or Voice over IP.
Okay, very good. We do have some questions. Representative
Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Spending this $1 million at this time, does this commit us to completing the capital project that would sort of then sort of get around a more complete discussion of this in our capital budgeting process this year? Again, if we spend this $1 million, are we absolutely obligated to include the rest of the money in this year's capital budget?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I don't know that we're absolutely obligated, but certainly what is needed almost immediately is to do an assessment of our current environment to determine what steps we need to take. And certainly if we have a catastrophic outage, the mere disruption of services and potential safety of life issues that exist by not having restored phone services within a very short period of time will be substantial, and it's a very high concern for myself as the agency responsible for phone services to the people that we serve.
Let me just kind of a quick follow-on. Thank you. So this million, as you describe it, is to, quote, initiate implementation. What specifically would you be doing, and is there a procurement process we're going to be following? Is there already a commitment to a vendor?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, what we've done, or what we've initiated doing, is we have some contracts currently in place, we being ETS, with some agencies through our task order system to establish a what we call building site assessments, as well as a PBX assessment to, again, substantiate the level of concern that we have. And then if, if there is a need to migrate on either to a new phone system, whether it's voice over IP or to stabilize their current environment, we'd make that decision at that time.
So what I'm hearing you say is this money is really to complete essentially a requirements definition and scoping process?
Through the chair, Representative Hunter, I believe that that would be my...
Different choice of words, but
yes.
That's basically what we're doing. Defining what our needs will be to obviously deal with our current phone problem, which I would be happy to stipulate for the records. You know, our telephone system is on its very last legs, and it may only be on one of them. But.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Thank you.
Very good. Sounds like you got a supporter of your preferred cause here. I did want to ask, is there money in the IT fund to help pay for this?
Mr. Chairman, for this particular project, we are requesting general fund. We do have some funding that was part of an appropriation made last year that we're going to be putting together with the $1 million that this appropriation is approved. That will be part of this this project. But there are not funds available where we could simply make this an ISF fund source and not capitalize it at this point for this purpose.
Then are you proposing setting up a recovery fund, a sinking fund, so that if this happens again, we have money available?
Mr. Chairman, that question was raised when we presented this project in the other body. We've had some preliminary discussions with legislative finance, and we're pondering that question with our accountants in the Department of Administration right now.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions? Okay. I just want to make sure you haven't decide yet on what type of system. Is that correct? You're doing a needs analysis at this point in time.
And to the chair, the state in years past and in the last year, we committed a $5 million investment into the infrastructure, into the wide area network through the Network Security Initiative. The intent is to move to a converged technologies. In other words, today, we have three separate systems. We have a phone system that we maintain and support separately. We have a data system, which we maintain and support separately, and a video system for video conferencing that we support separately. The intent is to converge those technologies into one platform and to ultimately save monies on not doing the maintenance and operation. So the decision, in my mind, yes, has been made in that we move towards a voice over IP, voice over internet protocol technology to a converged technology for this, yes.
Okay, and that will save us money by doing the voiceover?
I believe it will, yes.
Okay, have we had that type of system before?
To the chair, in the, I believe, year 2000, the state of Alaska entered into what's called the telecommunications partnering agreement with a telecommunications provider in Anchorage, ACS. That was a failed contract that was for telecommunications services, all inclusive. One of the components of that contract was to deploy a voice over internet protocol system. It is, in our analysis and in the analysis done by Cisco Systems as well as Northrop Grumman, we believe that the failure that was not due to the technologies, but it was due to the manner in which it was deployed, not using Cisco's best practices. Voice over IP runs today all over the world and is being used by large entities, banks, other corporations in Alaska, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation in Anchorage has moved to this technology. First National Bank of Alaska has moved to this technology. So we're very confident in its abilities to deliver the types of services and technologies that we want going forward.
Okay. And then you plan on spreading out the costs amongst all the different agencies? Is that the plan?
Mr. Chairman, we would once the whatever system we end up with here, if it's a new system, once that's in place, we would begin depreciating that asset in the Information Services Fund and collecting for that through our chargeback rates. That's correct.
Very good. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Well, thank you
for joining us. Okay, let's see where we're at. Office of Economic Development. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's correct. Commerce. Sections 2A and 2B. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And Department of Commerce have requested $75,000 statutory program receipts for the Boston Sea Patrol. This event is to provide the Alaska seafood sellers to show off to their buyers what is, you know, interesting and unique about Alaska. The last year, I believe, more than 600 and 800 people attended the show. And there are a lot of shows goes at the same time. It will be held something like, I think it's March 11th to 13th. And 13th is the Alaska Day. And the main thing here it is the buyers and sellers, they meet in the show and they make a lot of, you know, deals. One of the deals they make here it is they usually extend the existing contract or multiple shipments. That's what they do.
I'm sorry, we need to get for the record your name and affiliation.
Sorry about that. I'm Samuel Thomas, Admin Director of Department of Commerce. I have also here with me Mrs. Laura Fleming. She is the Communication Director for Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute.
Thank you.
This promotes a lot of seafood marketing for the state of Alaska. And the last year, while we were taking some statistic, is 16% of the people attended were they represent food services or bigger hotel chains or other shops. Now, 88% of the visitors have the purchasing authority. Another, we noticed that this year we got so far something like 86% of those people showed up in the last year. They are going to come back again. Because Alaska Day is the biggest day in that 3 days fish seafood show. The last year we had something like 15 seafood companies attended this one. And this year also we are expecting almost the same. And the last year we got $75,500 from these seafood industries. So far we have promised something like a little over $40,000, and it's almost one more month to go. Therefore, we are expecting almost the same amount. One of the biggest things Alaska seafood is facing is compete with the farmed salmon. Therefore, in the same show, the salmon of Americas and other seafood groups, they are also, you know, hold the same event in 11th and 12th of March. And but among this sellers and buyers, everybody thinks Alaska salmon is the best, and therefore that's really growing in the market.
No arguments here. Okay, anything else?
I don't have only the next.
Questions from committee members? I do have one. I noticed this was on the supplemental last year too, the money for the Boston Seafood Show. Is this in next year's budget? I mean, if this is something we're going to do every year, it seems like we should just go ahead and budget.
Yes, we just now did a amendment to the budget.
Okay.
$75,000.
Okay. Very good. And then what would happen if we did approve this in the supplemental?
Then we still have to come back and ask, because we don't know whether we can get all those money that we budgeted for from the fishing industry. because a lot of fishing industries are, some are big ones, some are small ones. Therefore, the donations usually stretch from $1,000 to $10,000. If we didn't get this one, then we may have to, you know, come up with some other, you know, source to support this event, because this is just to promote the fish for Alaska fishermen.
Okay. Very good. Any questions? Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. The next item.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, another question. Okay, go ahead.
We have one more item in the supplemental. That is a $395,000 supporter services receipts for the ASMI, Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. And this one is the matching money for the $1.2 million USDA market access program is already promised. Because recently the ASMI had a discussion with the USDA marketing assessing program managers, and they recommended that the Alaska fishing, they should really go forward with a little more aggressive attempt. In order to, because there are a lot of other, you know, fish items, just like a fam salmon or, you know, the other marketers are also competing with Alaska salmon. I am going to request, with your permission, Mr. Chair, to explain more about that to Ms. Laura.
Sure, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. This is an appropriation that would give us authorization to spend money that's already been collected. The seafood processors pay a tax, a seafood marketing assessment for ASPE's operations, and this money's already been collected, and we just don't have the authorization to expend it. If we have the authorization to expend it, then we will be able to go ahead and expend the federal dollars we've also already been allocated for this year. A lot of times the feds, the market access program that we get money under for our international marketing, they'll have an initial appropriation, and then the Congress will make an additional appropriation. And so in the middle of the year, we'll get another shot in the arm. They'll look at their cooperators and say, okay, good, we're going to give you another round of money. So the money's been collected. We're seeking the authorization to expend it. If we don't get it, what will happen? Well, we won't be able to expend that $800,000 or $900,000 this year of federal money.
Okay. Very good. Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I did hear you say that there was an additional federal appropriation that was not anticipated when we were preparing the budget last year. But then to the next question, why do we need to rush the expenditure here? Wouldn't this be equally appropriate to include in the state of Alaska's fiscal 07 regular budget instead of the 06 fast track supplemental?
We're also seeking increased authorization in the FY07 budget because, however, the main reason is because the industry will benefit from being able to put that money in the field now to support sales efforts and to keep the momentum going that is currently going for Alaska seafood in the international marketplace. The industry would like to be able to go ahead and spend the money. The industry sort of sought the money from the USDA, got it, kicked their ante in, and they just would like to be able to go ahead and spend. And they're going to plan to keep the momentum going next year. You'll see that the level of spending remains fairly strong and consistent.
You know, this is just one of those oversight responsibilities that we have. And I don't know if you've got anything, but something from ASME kind of on, you know, what they intend to do with this would certainly help me feel a little bit better about it.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? Seeing none, I think that's all for Commerce. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Okay, corrections. Let's see. corrections has 3A, B, and C.
For the record, my name is Charlene Griffin, Admin Services Director for the Department of Corrections. We're before you here today with three items, the first one being for our out-of-state contractual prison beds in the amount of $1,168.7. Currently in-state, we're over our emergency capacity of prison beds. Our emergency capacity is 3,206 beds. We're running approximately 3,476 inmates. We have offenders sleeping in boats, in the floor, in gyms, and a little bit of everywhere. This increment will provide taking the out-of-state bed contract from 760 beds to 1,000 beds by June 1st. It's a phased-in approach. We would send approximately 90 inmates around March 1st, 50 more in April, in May, and in June to take us to 1,000 beds.
Okay, any questions?
My obligatory question, sir.
Go ahead, Rick.
Day rate, please.
It is $58.90 a day. We're currently funded for 760 beds. We're running approximately 765 inmates there right now.
Go ahead.
Is it out of state or outstate or mix?
Through the chair. I'm sorry, could you say that one more?
In state, out of state, where are the beds?
Currently, we have our emergency capacity in-state is 3,206. This will take our out-of-state contract in Florence, Arizona, up to 1,000 beds.
And you said the day rate in Florence, Arizona is 58?
It's $58.90 a day.
Okay. How does that compare to our in-state rate?
The $58.90 a day is only the bed cost. Okay. There are additional costs for medical and programs and a few things like that. It also, this cost also does not include the probation officers stationed in Alaska to provide oversight to these offenders, and it also does not include transportation costs for sending inmates down and bringing them back.
Okay, very good. Director St. George?
It was the same question. What's the in-state bed rate?
The in-state bed rate is, I want to say 110.67, but I will have to double check that for you.
Okay. Yeah, that would be interesting to know. I know it's hard to make an accurate comparison, but it's obviously cheaper to in Florence, Arizona than here. But there are the costs of transportation costs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this work? Do all the inmates arrive like on the first of the month, or how does this process work?
No, the inmates, first of all, go through a classification system to determine if they can be sent to Arizona. Historically, we've been sending inmates that have 2 years to serve so that we're not sending them back and forth so much. However, we're down now with our in-state capacity to sending inmates who may only have as little as 14 months left. So, sometimes these offenders are sent down in loads of up to 100 prisoners on a U.S. Marshal jet. Sometimes it may be one of the public safety jets or the King Air that we send some. Occasionally there is the need to use a commercial airline, and we use Alaska Airlines to transport inmates back and forth.
Well, I guess my question is, do we need to fund for the whole month, or can we do partial month funding? Or?
For these beds?
Yeah.
This amount is actually a phased-in approach, sending some in March, some in April, some in May, and some in June. The transport dates, I don't know, and transport dates are confidential due to inmates being flown back and forth.
Okay. Richard Hawker, did you have a call?
Yeah, just so you said something in there, so I'll clarify. You indicated that transportation was on, and I believe I quote you exactly saying, one of the department's jets. Do we have more than one?
No, we don't. That was my error, sir.
Okay, didn't. Just wondering if you slipped one in on us.
No, sir.
Okay, very good. Any other questions on 3A? Okay, seeing none, do you want to continue, please?
The next request that we have is for inmate health care. We're requesting a supplemental of $2.6 million. Year to date, we have identified $1.9 million in catastrophic cases. These range from lung cancers, dialysis patients, breast cancer, congestive heart failure, stroke, sepsis, HIV, a number of things down to, we do have a case that was an altercation between inmates. With these costs year to date being $1.9 million, we anticipate that we will need a total of $2.6 million to pay for our catastrophic cases and for increased health care costs in general.
Questions? Representative Hopper?
No, sir, this is, one more time, rising medical costs are our continuing problem in corrections, workman's comp, Medicaid, and our retirement programs.
Yeah. Okay, I do have a question. Do the inmates pay it all if they can, their medical?
Yes, they do. We have a copay system. We charge inmates $4 per visit to our medical practitioners and nurses, and we charge them a copay if they are taken to an outside doctor. In addition, if there is an altercation, there will be a disciplinary hearing, and there are many occasions that the offenders are ordered to pay the state back for a portion of those costs. We collect probably about $80,000 a year in copay fees from inmates.
Okay, so how much, I apologize to you, I haven't done my research, how much was spent in 06 and how much do we have budgeted in 07? Is there enough so we don't have this problem next year?
These cases are catastrophic cases. They're beyond the amounts that we would budget for. They vary every year. So we are requesting a supplemental of $2.6 million. In our FY07 budget, we have an increment for $1.3 million, and that is, in general, rising health care costs and does not account for catastrophic cases that may occur next year.
Okay. And then I'm assuming when you say you potentially run out of funds, you don't know for sure, you know, that the disease or the health problems that's going to come up.
Right.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Seeing none. Okay. Let's move up. Okay. 3C.
Our final request, 3C, is for $755,000, also in inmate health care. This is an FY05 supplemental. We did receive a supplemental in FY05 in the vicinity of $500,000. It did not cover the cost throughout the remainder of the year. We had many more catastrophic cases towards the end of the year. We currently owe Alaska Regional Hospital about $255,000, Carondelet Health Network in Arizona around $300,000, CCA, our contractor for Florence Correctional Center, around $120,000, and we have approximately $80,000 that we owe to fee-for-service vendors.
Okay, I guess the obvious question I have is, why didn't we, why wasn't this picked up in last year's supplemental?
There were cases that occurred after our supplemental was requested and towards the end and after the end of session last year that we did not anticipate.
Okay. And then how much did we pay in interest on this?
We are paying approximately $85,000 in interest on this.
Okay. Very good. Any, Dr. Hopper?
And thank you, sir. Same question as Chairman Meyer, but the next step. We're in here asking for in the FY06 supplemental budget, asking for an FY05 supplemental.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't those procedurally or technically, don't we tend to take those as ratifications?
Through the chair, generally we do if they have been paid and they need ratified. These obligations actually have not been paid. Inmate health care is a single component RDU, and when the appropriated funds were gone, there was no way to pay them other than crossing appropriations, which is not legal.
commissioners might offer. That's never stopped Health and Social Services.
All right. Okay. Anything else? Seeing that, thank you very much for joining us today. Okay, DMBA, Mr. Kramer. Let's see what we have here. Just one section, section 4A, fund transfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Kramer. I'm the Admin Service Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. We have one item before you today on Section 4A. It's a fund transfer for the Disaster Relief Fund. We're asking for $4,143,800. There's a narrative under the supplemental need that explains to you what it is that we're requesting and why we're requesting it, but basically it's for disasters that have taken place since 2002 through 2005. I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have with regard to those specific disasters or needs.
Yeah, the disasters are all listed, and these are big ones. We've all heard about them. Rex Hawker, did you have one?
No, sir. Thank you.
Does any of that?
Go ahead, Bruce.
Does any of that money go out the form of vouchers or debit cards or anything like that?
Through the chair to Representative Weirach, we have what's called an individual assistance program. People are eligible up to $5,000 to be able to apply for assistance if they can justify and show the damage caused that or substantially more than that. And so they make application to our department and we process those and so up to $5,000.
Okay, very good. Yeah, just looking at the various disasters now. Pretty familiar with most of them. When it says 2005 Southeast Storm, is that the heavy rains we had?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
There's a few guesses right here in this hall.
We had a mudslide come through a person's bedroom, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Are these all full funding or were some of them matches?
No, some of them are matches, Mr. Chairman. You'll notice, for instance, the Bering Strait sea storm. That's was also declared a federal disaster, and the reason why you don't see these closed out as rapidly as what we may like to is because sometimes we get in a bit of a discussion with FEMA on what is allowed under the disaster to be charged, and if we can get items allocated under the FEMA program, the Federal Disaster Program, they fund it 75%, we fund it 25%. So there's some issues that have taken place in both of these, the 02 and the 04, that we're just now getting authorization from FEMA to go ahead and they will pay the 75% and we will pay the 25%, and that's why you're seeing those.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? Seeing that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's see. We did the Department of Law. Are we now on Natural Resources, is that correct? Okay. Natural Resources. Mr. Nico Bus. Nico, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nico Bus, and I'll be addressing sections 6A through C on your lines 11 through 14. Our Division of Parks is having a revenue shortfall this year. Their budget is required to collect about $2.3 million worth of park receipts. Our best projections right now are that they collect about $1.7 million, so we have a significant shortfall. We realized that in the fall, and so we've been working with this organization to see how we could get them to still provide the services that the legislature and the administration would like them to provide and keep all the park units open. Our request to you is to switch $350,000 of the receipts supported services to general funds. That would help. And then the agency has implemented various efficiency measures as well as trying to raise revenue wherever they could. One thing is a problem in this budget structure is that the Division of Parks budget is in its own RDU, so it's its own appropriation, So lines 12, 13, and 14 are requesting this organization to be switched into the rest of the DNR resource development. That would allow this organization to benefit from any potential lapse. Most of our revenues come in during May and June, and so if we for some reason do not hit these projections, then it will allow the agency to transfer some of their potential lapse at the end of the fiscal year to allow to keep the park units open. But that, Mr. Chairman, if there's any questions, I can answer.
Any questions?
I'd be delighted to, sir.
Go ahead, Mr. Zucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nico, let's break this into two pieces. There's the increment, we're just not collecting as much in those little drop boxes as we tried to budget. Any reference that's going to be necessary to reduce service levels in the parks. Can you be very specific on, should we choose not to fund this one, what services you will reduce?
That's a good question, Sir Chair, Representative Hawker. The write-up that we submitted has a service reduction plan in there. It's on pages 3, 4, and 5 of it. Basically, because they're on their own appropriation, we asked them what would happen the same as you did. We went through this in 2003 and was not a happy occurrence when we tried to reduce park service or actually close some park units. And so our aim and the legislative direction has been to try to keep all parks units open. What we would do is trying to either reduce or limit service level, thereby saving either seasonal staff or contractual services. And so there was four criteria that we used. We would try to minimize the impact on any single geographic location, in other words, spread the impact throughout the state. We would try to further financial losses, look at parks with lower revenue generation and higher cost and lower visitation. We would also try to reorganize our own organization to fit within the new reality, and we are limited to an extent by our union contract and that. And then the last one is we would definitely try to keep some service in all the park units. Based on these criteria, we would reduce service in about 26 park units and limit service in another 36 park units. And we can go into each one of these, and the write-up kind of explains what that would mean. Is that kind of answering your question?
Mr. Chairman, that's general. You know, it's a general explanation, but again, do you have a, so that we can consider this in, you know, truly consider the consequences, an item is a, you know, a much more detailed description of what park units you would intend to impact and what services you would not provide, you know, whether you indicate sometimes it's janitorial, it could be trash collection, it could be providing firewood, and I'd be, you know, really interested in knowing what would be your, you know, the very specific consequences to which specific you know, facility.
And we can provide that information. Within a certain limitation, you know, like I said, there are certain union contract requirements that if we would reduce a park ranger in one unit, they could bump somewhere else. And but we'd be happy to work with you and provide you that detail.
You know, it would be particularly helpful to me. You know,
okay.
I have to say, it would be very helpful
okay.
for information. If I may, sir,
go ahead, please.
Second section. This business of really rewriting, restructuring the RDU and component structure within your the budget year we're operating in currently to create greater latitude to allow you to shift funds within a BRU. And again, I acknowledge that Representative Kelly, who is responsible for this in this body, is not here today to address this. So with respect, I'm trying to put myself in his shoes, big shoes to fill. But would it be more appropriate in this year's budget, the supplemental request, to offer increments and decrements to move money around the budget rather than having us in the supplemental process literally restructuring the RDU component levels of the budget? And then if you wish to make that proposal, would it not be better to bring that before the budget subcommittee in our regular budget process this year?
Through the chair, Representative Hawk, those are real valid points. First of all, we proposed this structure in the fiscal year 07 budget, so it will be a discussion in the subcommittee. That meeting will take place next Thursday with our subcommittee. The reason for not asking for an add and delete in our DNR appropriation is that when we ask all the other divisions, they say they'll be spending their money. Reality is that towards the end of June, if there's an unexpected vacancy or whatever, there might be some monies that will become available. And so if they are not, if the parks operation is not within the resource development, then even if there is money available, we couldn't lapse it. The other alternative is to force it and just tell somebody to reduce service, and that is, again, something that you, as a chairman of a subcommittee, would like to have a say over. So we, first of all, asked the Division of Parks to implement all the austerity measures that they could without reducing services, and they are doing that. Then we said, to the extent that we can help them, we try to do that. But some of that, because they are in their own appropriation, we have to wait till probably June to see if there's any money left.
Mr. Chairman, good response. This is one of those that I'm very, very interested in seeing what the subcommittee thinks of the approach.
Very good. Thank you, Nico. It sounds like Kelly's subcommittee is going to be very
busy.
Good, so, yeah. Okay, any other questions for Nico? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's see, where are we at? Public. Next area is public safety. Let's see,
you should
have Mr. Spencer.
Yeah. Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dan Spencer, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Public Safety. Section 7 would appropriate $350,000 of general fund to the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault to be awarded as a grant to the Kotzebue Domestic Violence Shelter. The existing grant funds have been awarded. They've been awarded via competitive grant. Where we left off at the end of last session, I think, is there was some discussion about the Department of Health and Social Services had made a preliminary determination that the Kotzebue shelter might not have been eligible for continued funding that had been passed through from HESS. Apparently that came to pass that it was not eligible. So what this is a request to get them funding for this year. We have funding also in the governor's FY07 budget, and then in FY08 it would roll into the regular competitive grants process.
Yeah,
thank you. There was some communication from the commissioner, and the number that was consistently talked about over the summer was $250,000. Where did this growth occur?
Representative Stoltz, I am not certain. This amount, it's my understanding, is the amount that Manilik, who's operating the shelter, feels is actually going to be necessary. And so they may have revised their estimate. I don't know.
There's always a chance that my memory is flawed and I didn't hear the right number, but I don't think that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoltz, certainly we can, and the commissioner will be here in about 45 minutes, and we'll certainly have to discuss that with you.
Okay, very good. Now, if we provide this funding, does that jeopardize getting the grant? My understanding, we're also eligible for federal money or federal.
No, there is a federal appropriation out there that we're trying to determine the scope of it. I think it was a $5 million federal appropriation. This does not affect that at all.
It's not impacted.
That's correct.
Okay, very good. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I suspect you probably won't have the answer here, but it's one I'd like to have requested by the committee. Apparently there was a Health and Social Services grant that, whatever reason, this institution, this project, this shelter fell outside the allowable grant parameters. I'd be real interested in, and I don't see any decrements or, you know, reduction in budget at the Department of Health and Social Services. I'd be very curious to know where the original intent was to fund this from, so that we could take a look and see what consequences we might have within the social services budget.
Mr. Chairman,
what the source was, my issue being, were we looking, are we shifting a, what was a federal program attempt, federal funding attempt, to general fund?
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to that. We would have to ask the Department of Health and Social Services.
All right. Mr. Joel,
not to answer Representative Hawker's question, but just a comment. In an effort to provide the service, the Medical Association have been fronting this cost so that it continues so that there's no break in service.
Right.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr.
Chairman.
Okay, revenue. So we have Mr. Bartholomew. And he has, this is section.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Bartholomew, and I'm with the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And we have one supplemental request, which is section number 8, line 16 in the spreadsheet. This is a request that the board and the executive director are requesting to be able to initiate kind of a review and analysis of the gas line investment, and I just wanted to walk through 3 points. And we testified last week in the Senate Finance Committee on this, and this is to clarify some of the questions that they had asked us to go back and respond to. And the first one is just that there had been some media reports that this was a general funded appropriation, and so I just wanted to clarify that this is a request that's coming from the corporation, and it would be funded by corporate receipts, which is in essence an income from the investments, and that's how we fund all of our operating budget. The second item was the $550,000. How did we determine that amount, and is that an accurate estimate? And the response is it's very difficult to estimate exactly what would be expended to do a complete analysis of a potential investment, because as you know, there hasn't been an agreement reached between the state and the producers on to exactly what type of investment we would be evaluating. So our estimate is based on two phases. Phase one would be there is need for the board to go through an education process on what's called infrastructure investing, which is an asset class that's been growing over the last 5 years. But the permanent fund has not yet invested in that type of an asset class, and the gas line or a regulated infrastructure investment would fall into that category. So we do want to have hire an advisor / investment consultant to actually come in and bring the board up to speed on that type of an investment. And if that's the only phase that was completed in FY06, we would spend less than $550,000, considerably less. But if an agreement was reached and there was an actual proposal presented to the state and to the legislature and to potential investors, then we would be evaluating how much is it going to take to do that, and we would have to be getting some cost estimates from our contractors, and part of that work would probably carry over into FY07. But it, whether it would be exactly 550 or more, is difficult. But we feel comfortable that we would, spend only what is necessary, and anything that isn't expended would remain in the permanent fund. And then the last question was a question of, well, why is this in the fast track supplemental? If you already have authority to evaluate investments, why are you asking the legislature for this? And in our FY06 operating budget, we currently have approximately $300,000 that is used for pre-investment fiduciary work, looking at the investment, looking at the returns, looking at the facts behind the investment. We are currently evaluating a large real estate investment, and there was a media release this week that we've made an offer on a large real estate operating company where we've already expended this $300,000 in pre-investment analysis. How our budget works is if we do actually make the investment, then the cost of that upfront due diligence is just added to the cost of the investment, and that's the cost, and it does not charge against our operating budget. If our analysis says it's a bad investment, don't complete the investment, that money comes into our operating budget, so the legislature and the public are aware of what money we are spending. So currently, with this project that we've made an offer on, and it's being accepted, but it's going through the closing due diligence process, They expect that if it closes, it'll close by late March or April. And if it does, then that $300,000 would be freed up and be available for another due diligence project. But our concern is being able to be prepared before the end of March, have an advisor starting the education process with the board, and being able to enter into a contract. And we really can only comfortably enter into a contract if we think we've got the appropriated funds. So again, if we were to get a fast-track appropriation and we were able to complete the other real estate investment that we're investigating, we would end up with, you know, excess authorization that would then lapse at the end of FY06. So that's the main points of what led the executive director and the board to request the supplemental.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. We do have some questions. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer, Mr. Bartholomew. Last year we had legislation before the committee that expanded, or I guess removed, the limits of your investment opportunities, and there were questions related to gas line investments, the possibility, and there was a little bit of coyness on the part of Mr. Burns. And I'm just wondering how much of this activity is an extension of what you sought through the legislative change through the statute last year. And is this connected to your increased opportunities on become more involved in the gas line?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Stoltz. The authority of the Permanent Fund for Investments prior to the bill that passed the legislature last year had our core investment stocks, bonds, real estate, and then it allowed us to invest up to 10% of the fund in alternative investments. And roughly speaking, that would say prior to last year's legislation, you could invest up to $3 billion in alternative investments. And at the time the legislation had passed, we had currently allocated about 2% to be going into alternatives, private equity, and what's called absolute return or hedge funds. The authority to look at an infrastructure investment or a gas line investment does fall into the alternative investments category. Just using rough numbers, the numbers that have been thrown out as potential investments would be a 20% state ownership in the gas line. If you said, use those numbers and said the permanent fund was considering providing half of the state investment, if it goes through the due diligence and it makes sense, our understanding it would be about a $2 billion to $2.5 billion potential investment. The amount of cash that the permanent fund would put into that investment would be roughly $500 million. It's that $500 million that is considered as investment of the principal of the permanent fund, or of the investment of the fund. You're talking about 1.5% or 2% of the fund, probably closer to 1.5%. So we had the authority before last year's legislation to invest in the gas line, but as you start doing more and more investments, we were going to start approaching that 10% limit. So I would say the legislation doesn't have a direct effect on whether we do or don't evaluate or invest in the gas line, but it definitely has an effect on whether you would ever have more than 10% of your fund in these types of investments. And currently, our current allocation has changed since last year, when I mentioned we had roughly 2% allocated, excluding the pipeline. We currently have 8% allocated, 4% in absolute return, and 4% in private equity. There's a lot less than that actually out the door in investments, but our targets is over the next 2 or 3 years to move towards it. So the summation of those two would be, if we were to go out and look at the potential gas line investment, we would certainly be approaching 10%, you know, sometime in the next 3 to 5 years. And that legislation would absolutely have been necessary to go over the 10%. So it's not a consideration in the next 3 or 4 years. We won't have exceeded the authority we had, but sometime in that time frame it would have. And you probably would not make you know, several large investments with that 10% limitation, because you wouldn't have any room to grow, and these aren't the type of investments that you can get out of quickly. So it would have been a big consideration.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bartholomew, where did the initiative for this, what's the genesis for this initiative? Where did it come from in the administration? Or
I think there's been two sources, I guess, of interest in how you, or why would we invest in the gas line. One of them has just been a general interest that's been out there. I think just for several years there's been an interest of, should the state own a part of a infrastructure, and the board and the executive director have pretty much said we tried to stay out of that discussion. We have watched as other funds have invested in the capital infrastructure, so we're aware that there's that asset class and that option. And then that was the first, just a broad general interest. The second interest came when one of the board members, who's also the Commissioner of Revenue, part of the Governor's Cabinet, and I don't have the exact date with me, but in the last 2 or 3 months, had approached the Executive Director and the Chair of the Board to express interest that the Permanent Fund should, you know, through its normal process, consider looking at an investment in the pipeline. So those are the two pieces that I'm aware of.
So this came, Mr. Chairman, this came from the commissioner, one of the designees who is a commissioner for the administration.
Yes, that was one of the areas of interest.
That's okay for now.
Okay, rest in control.
Question answered.
So that's very good. Okay, we have some more. Rest in water.
Since nothing's really going to happen on gas pipeline negotiations until the legislature at all adopts a change to the oil tax structure, which probably wouldn't be going in recession, why is this needed to fast track in the way for the appropriation?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, I think if that's the, you know, the likely scenario that plays out, the actual part of our contract that we were looking at, where you're actually specifically doing the investigation of an actual deal or actual proposed investment, we wouldn't begin that until then, and we would have two options at that time. We would either have a new fiscal year, FY07, where we do have money for pre-investment due diligence, so we wouldn't need the supplemental. Or if the real estate deal that we're working on now is successfully completed, that would free up money. So what it would do if we don't have the supplemental is it probably could put the contract, the identification of who would be this board's advisor, and actually beginning an education part. We've got one phase of the contract, which is purely to look at our portfolio and how is it constructed, and how would an asset such as a pipeline fit into the existing portfolio? Is the risk and return attributes of that appropriate for us? So that's the part that we believe would make sense to start now and get us down the path, and that would just be delayed a couple months.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Bob. Just for the second half of the same question that Representative Wyrock asked, it seems to me, as I listen to you present this and see, you know, the management latitude that you currently have to pursue investments within your own budget, which is, you know, not a specific budget that we approve, isn't this something that is, all things being equal, you really have the existing management latitude to pursue this sort of research, but it seems to me what you're brought forward to us is really more of a, it seems to me almost more of a courtesy review for legislative endorsement. And would you agree with that?
I think it's two parts. I don't think we historically come to the legislature regarding investments, but we would not want to undertake an investment if we felt we wouldn't have the budgetary resources to cover it. So we wouldn't take on the risk of evaluation of an investment if it fails and we don't have the money in our operating budget to cover liabilities that we incurred. So from that perspective, We're trying to mitigate our risk of entering into too many contracts that we are not able to fund. So that's a kind of a legitimate budgetary appropriation authority that we're requesting. The second part of getting acceptance or approval from the legislature, I think the board and the executive director are sensitive and are interested in the legislature's view on this and are not looking to get, crosswise or ahead of the legislature. So they're certainly not opposed to the feedback from the legislature on their thoughts of the permanent fund evaluating, an investment in the gas line. So it's appreciated, but we also have the need for make sure we have the legal appropriation authority.
I think we find out that the circumstances evolving here, I think we clearly got the authority to pursue it, an adequate authority, but I would certainly wish other departments would be so assiduous in coming before us to make sure they have authority before they spend money. That's definitely laudable. The second point, more to the specifics of what you intend to, were this to be funded, where you would, the investment structure that you would be reviewing. Are you contemplating an investment that would be a direct equity holding in whatever entity actually owned the pipe, or would you be looking at investing in the debt securities of those entities that owned the pipe?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, there's a lot of different scenarios that we hear about. We're not currently involved at all as a part of the negotiating team, so I'm not aware of any specifics of a particular proposal that's being made. Typically, any of the investments we've made of this type, whether it's a Tyson's Mall, one of our largest investments, or some of the new small private equity companies, startup businesses that we're investing in, they're done through establishment of a corporation or an LLC, and then the ownership of the investment of the gas line, as I understand it, would be in some sort of holding company, and the permanent fund would look to invest in that holding company, and you can do it in a couple of ways, one of which is we could just loan them money as debt or issue, be in essence, buying bonds of that company, or more likely the way we've done it is we actually would own that entity or have an equity interest, and you can call it you own stock in it, or it's basically your financial investment in it. So the typical scenario would be where we would invest money into an entity and own a percentage of that corporation, and however that's organized, that company, whether it's just the state's share or in partnership with the producers, they would own the pipeline, we would own a percentage of it. And it could be debt, where we're loaning them money and getting a straight interest payment, or it could be an equity interest where, again, it's a regulated investment, so you're probably going to get a regulated investment return, which is kind of the attraction of this type of an investment, but it's called an equity interest.
Sure. A huge difference between equity investment and investing in the debt of someone who has an equity investment, clearly. The risk matrix is entirely different. And would you contemplate that if you took that equity position, which certainly assures a higher regulated rate of return, then you would get purchasing the debt of an investor? But would that include taking some downside risk for potential cost overruns and that sort of thing?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, if you're purely issuing debt, it's usually more secure and more set in the payment stream you're going to receive. If you're an equity owner, it can range all the way from you're taking on all the completion risk, construction, cost overruns, determining whether there's always going to be a full pipeline or a half-full pipeline. All of those risks would be assumed if you're taking an equity interest. And the return generally for you to go into those type of risks would be higher. So there is a trade-off between the risk you take, the return you get, and that's that's a big reason of why we would want an advisor who's experienced and worked on these projects taking an independent look at how much risk are you taking, how much return are you expecting, and what are the probabilities of you achieving the return.
So this discussion of the various
different risks associated with different vehicles, whether it's simply a fairly finite debt risk or an equity investor. You've got the ullage risk, you've got the cost overruns risk, you've got the whole matrix of ownership risk. That analysis, a complete and thorough analysis of all those different risk components of different structures, would be contemplated in this work?
Currently, yes, and we have a draft scope of services that we'd be proposing to have advisors bid on. We aren't saying look at all the potential options that are available for how would you finance a gas pipeline. At this point, we've asked them, we've instructed them to say, we're assuming that we're going to be delivered a package, similar to what they're saying to the legislature. The negotiators will come to an agreement of how they best think it can work, and they will present a proposal. It's our understanding we would be evaluating that proposal to see if it's an appropriate investment. We have some language in here that also says they might be able to, they must be able to support us in negotiating and drafting terms of an agreement, so that there may be some negotiation. But I think our anticipation is that the bulk of that analysis of what the negotiators believe is the best way for the state to proceed will be the deal that's negotiated and brought forward to the legislature, and one that we would be evaluating. So
this particular funding then, would, should it come to pass, would be to evaluate a particular structure brought to you by the administration, rather than, as opposed to the permanent fund seeking professional counsel to determine what might be the most, or to look at alternatives that you might be interested in. This is strictly to evaluate one proposal you anticipate being brought forward by the administration.
To the Chair, President Hocker, that's currently how I understand it, that there will be, you know, one proposal put together, and we would be evaluating it from an institutional fund, investment fund perspective of is it appropriate, and there's a lot of reasons that it might be a good investment or a good expenditure for the state from a much broader perspective than the permanent funds, but we're not taking that broader look. We think our mandate and the board's mandate is to look at it from the guise of the guidelines that we've been given both in statute and constitution as a just an investment fund, taking a look at this.
One last question, so I promise you. And that would be, is it, given that you're also, you know, like the rest of the world, you know, the world waits, this would seem to be an awfully premature authorization at this point, when we frankly don't even know, no pun intended, but we don't know if there's even going to be a gas line proposal brought forward anytime in the foreseeable future. It just seems to be rather premature to be us committing this kind of expenditure at this time.
To the Chair, Representative Hocker, I think it's two things. One, I mean, we would agree that we don't want to expend the funds unnecessarily or prematurely, but we also don't want to be in a situation where, you know, we don't know when it's going to be presented, and that it is presented, and then we're scrambling or trying to figure out a schedule to get the board together. So this is really to be prepared to start with the education piece, which would be not that expensive. You know, realistically, you're talking, you know, $50,000 to $100,000, possibly at top, to have them look at how such an investment would fit into our fund, and explaining and going through this type of asset class. And then the rest of the funds would not be expended until there was an agreement. We would not have a deal to to evaluate. So it's a step of being prepared and not spending the money before you need to.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good.
Mr.
Robert.
Yeah, I was going to ask the question Representative Parker finished with, and that is, it doesn't take hundreds of thousands of dollars for a consultant to say it's too soon to tell, and it's too, we don't have enough information to be able to reasonably advise you one way or the other on proposals. To me, it seems premature to invest this kind of money in something that's completely unknown. It also has the appearance of being pressured by the executive branch to do something that may
not be in the fiduciary duty or responsibility of the board to independently evaluate things in a very cautious manner for the benefit of the state of Alaska who are recipients of the benefits of the fund. It seems to be bending the pressure a bit to request the appropriation, and that's a concern.
Through the chair, Representative Wire, I think it's sort of a catch-22. The longer we wait, the more pressure that's going to build when there's actually a proposal. We're going to have to move very quickly. If we start sooner and do the education piece, and I guess part of the education isn't specific to the Alaska Gas Line. I was speaking to the head of a public fund in Vancouver, British Columbia, this morning, and it's a $75 billion fund, and they have 5% of their, so $3.5 billion is their allocation to public infrastructure. And they've been evaluating and studying investments and hiring staff for about 5 years. And so they're quite mature in this asset class. So what we'd be starting with is learning about this asset class. So it steps, you know, the first parts of education wouldn't even be specific to the gas line, but then we would go into educating the board on how do regulated investments work, how are they different. So there's a broader piece of education that would be valuable if we never invested in the gas line. So it has several purposes.
Very good. Good discussion, and I'm sure we'll have more on this particular topic. So thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. We're gonna stop here. We're running out of time. We will have our co-chairman of finance back tomorrow, and this is the operating budget is more along the lines of his responsibility. So he'll continue the discussion here on the fast track. We only have DOT left. Sorry, and we'll get you first thing tomorrow, as well as we'll also be taking up the. The other, energy related pipeline and miscellaneous fast track. I think that one actually will take a little longer. So we'll finish this one and pick up the other energy fast track tomorrow. And that'll be it. We won't take up House Bill 150 until next Tuesday. That was the one that I think we would take up Thursday, but we'll hold that over to next Tuesday. That had to do with the radiology technicians. And we'll try to actually take up all the pending bills next Tuesday and just finish the supplementals on tomorrow. So let's see, we not meeting on Friday, and we have Monday's a holiday, so yeah, next week then we'll meet Tuesday through Friday. Okay, anything to come before the committee this time? No, sure.